CBSI on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution writing and defining ideas about a matter that's before the United States Supreme Court right now. The case turns on National Pork Producers Council versus Ross, which is a challenge to a proposition passed in California referendum in 2018, Proposition 12. But in order to explore the challenge and also what we can anticipate from the court, we need to heed to the Constitution itself, the very famous and very controversial Commerce Clause. It reads that Congress shall, quote, have the power to regulate commerce among the several states. That is the important part here. It also speaks of foreign affairs. But more interestingly, Richard introduces us not only to what I just read, Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce among the several states, but also the dormant Commerce Clause. This is a revelation to me, but it's a significant debating point among constitutional lawyers and members of the Supreme Court for many generations. Richard, a very good evening to you. What is the dormant Commerce Clause? Good evening.
Yes, well, of course, the dormant Commerce Clause is not something that is written in the Constitution. So the word clause has to be put in quotation marks. But from the very beginning, the question was whether or not when Congress had the power over certain domains, whether that power was exclusive or whether it was shared with the state being concurrent. And it turns out we kind of have a split verdict on this. For certain kinds of things, it turns out that the federal government and the state are both able to regulate. And in some particular cases, it is said that the power that the federal government has precludes the state from engaging in certain forms of regulation. This is not a novel confection. The first instance of the Dormant Commerce Clause being brought into play was the first instance in which the Commerce Clause was brought into play. It was a case called Gibbons and Ogden. And the grand question before the court was the extent to which the federal government had the power to regulate commerce between Elizabethtown, New Jersey, and New York City. And there was a effort on the part of Chancellor Kent, a great justice in New York, to say the Federal Commerce Clause only allowed you to regulate transactions at the border, but did not extend into the interior of the state, at which point there's no real Commerce Clause at all. Chief Justice Marshall took this case over, and he said the entire journey is now going to be subject to this power. Well, what happened in this particular case was that the state decided to grant a patent to Fulton, which was then transferred. And the issue is whether or not that patent, which gave exclusive rights over the waters in New York State, could exclude the boats from coming in. And what happened is he said no. And it was a bit of a fiddle. He said, in part, we've given licenses to boats to go up and down. And so the clear implication of the license that the federal government gives is that the state patent system cannot control. And so that's an argument. There was an implied power that overrides the state's inherent power. But there was a concurring opinion by one of the justices who said, no, just the bare fact that you have a commerce clause there means that states cannot disrupt the situation, even if the federal government does not enter into it. The importance of this last distinction is that the original design, one guesses, is that the founders were very concerned to make sure that there was a national market in goods and services that can go across state lines in order to get the maximum gains from trade. They thought originally, one supposes, that the federal government would have the power to enforce that national market. But by 1825, the census began to occur that the federal government's not going to do anything much with respect to its power. There are too many divisions. Think of the conflicts between the North and the South before the Civil War. So the court decides to step in. And this is a decidedly pro-competitive innovation. Whether it's consistent with the original stuff or not is debated. And what you're trying to do is to create that national market by preventing states from balkanizing it. And if you start looking at some of the early cases, this is what you discover. If you take milk, for example, there's a case called Nevia against New York, and the court is eager to allow a state to impose price controls on all stuff that's consumed within the state. But the moment it turns out that you've got a federalism involved, the next year in a case called Baldwin and Selig, all of a sudden, same Justice Cardozo says, you cannot put prejudice on foreign milk coming into New York State because federalism requires this to be kept open.
And that was a unanimous decision that has to weigh on this.
Yes, it was 1935. Maybe it was 1934. So what's clearly going on is that the Supreme Court of itself starts to move in two directions simultaneously. One, if the national government wants to take over all of commerce, including feeding your own grain to your own cows, it can do so and it can form cartels. And at the same time, you get Baldwin and Selig. The Roosevelt administration was forming hundreds of different cartels for different commodities. And the Supreme Court said, just fine. And Justice Jackson, the earlier Justice Jackson, Robert Jackson, not the recent appointee, to whom congratulations. But the earlier Justice Jackson said, well, the only way that you could make sure that the cartel is going to be enforced is to make sure that people can't duck it by feeding their own corn to their own cow. Then 7 years later, in a case called Bean Milk, but he says, by God, the state of Wisconsin cannot prevent Illinois milk from coming into the state by imposing a phony health rationale on this situation. And so what you see are two polar opposites. And what has happened over time is that the Dormant Commerce Clause seems to have slipped a little bit in that more and more state regulation seems to be appropriate. And the flashpoint comes in those particular states, cases where the state has no domestic industry to regulate, but there's a foreign industry that sends massive imports into the state that it would like to regulate. If there's a local industry of substantial size and a foreign one, the dominant principle is you can figure out the regulations you want, but you cannot impose heavy restrictions on the outsider than you impose on the insider. And so, for example, you can't say that trucks that come in from across the state line have to pay 10 times the license of a domestic person or more per axle on the use of roads or a whole host of things. And this is extremely important to keep this market alive. But the pork case, which came up for the Supreme Court, domestic production was about 0.1% of the nation's supply, and domestic consumption was about 13%. And so what the state did in that particular case, California, they said, we will not allow you to import pork into this state if it is made in facilities that do not meet with our requirements on the amount of space that you give per pig and whether or not you put them in common bins when they start to.
That's the case that's before the court now. But I want to muddy the waters a little bit before we come to California.
Feel free.
Because you give me license to do this. You link to a 2015 article that you published about the Dormant Commerce Clause. I come to this as an innocent. I'm wandering into common sense, I believe. I'm looking at the Trucking Association decision of 1987, where Pennsylvania was imposing a flat axle tax on trucks outside of Pennsylvania as well as trucks inside from Pennsylvania. Trucking is something that's commonplace across the country. The Supreme Court was not friendly to this decision, and my note says that it struck it down. Now, that indicates to me that the Supreme Court is not they're not ambivalent about this. If they see that a state is trying to take advantage of its authority in order to punish people from outside, they've moved effectively to stop that.
It was a great decision. It was essentially a decision by Justice Stevens, one of his very best opinion. And the point about an axle tax as opposed to a mileage tax is if you're a Pennsylvania company, you make many more miles on the same axle than a foreign company coming into the state. So the tax is essentially a barrier to entry by foreign states. And what he said is you can't do this. And what he then did is he said, suppose we imagined every state doing this thing. What you would do is you come up with complete balkanization of the nation.
Right.
And he says, we can't allow these things to deviate. So one of the things that's so important about this is in order to have a cooperative solution, every state has to play the same game. If you're going to allow this to be up to state choices, you're going to see states deviate from the dominant solution and create serious stuff. I may have mentioned in that article a case called Mormon, in which Justice Scalia made, I think, a big mistake when he allowed, when you're talking about the taxation of foreign property inside your state, i.e. property owned by foreign corporations, everybody used to use the same three-part formula, and Iowa wanted to use only one part of that formula in order to be able to extract more gains from an Illinois corporation. And Scalia was willing to go with that. And in fact, back in 1984, when we had our debate about the interpretive nature of the Constitution and whether or not we protected economic liberties, he was willing to allow the balkanization, and I was not. And so this debate that we have goes back a very long time. What was the justification that Scalia had? He was much more of a textualist and less of a structuralist than I am. And he says, I just see a power here. I don't see it labeled as exclusive. So therefore, the states can do whatever they want until the federal government preempts them. I think that's probably a mistake.
One of the revelations in your essay is that Justice Scalia can wander from the center and take a position that seems illogical from the from the cases that have come before. It's surprising to me. It's as if one of the reasons he was creative is that he could get on the wrong side of an issue and stay there.
Along with Justice Thomas. Let's just be very clear about that. And who is a champion on the other side? Is people like Justice Breyer. Because it turns out textualism has its own limitations. And what happened is that both Thomas and Scalia agreed with a position which in one sentence says, the Commerce Clause gives power to the federal government. It does not impose any limitation on the states. And that is inconsistent with everything that was said from the beginning of time, going back to 1825. The question is how far you go. And the reason it's such an important issue is if you look at what's taking place in the national pork case, they say, look, this pork is just fine. It's the same as any other pork that comes into the state. But we're going to tell you in Tennessee or in Illinois, how you're supposed to raise your animal. And so there are two arguments against it. One is, what do a bunch of activists sitting in California know about how to raise animals and so forth? And it turns out the question of their health findings was heavily contested by the pork industry. I'm not going to adjudicate that question, although when I read the documents, I thought the pork industry knew more about the subject, because generally insiders know more than outsiders.
Richard, let us wait to take on the pork case in the new segment, because we're dealing with the assertions of the Healthcare Without Harm group in California, who concern themselves with animal cruelty, that is somewhat different than concerning yourselves with the health of the people of California. Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, helping me to understand the long, long, long and muddled trail of the Commerce Clause, especially the Dormant Commerce Clause. He began in 1820. He went to 1934 and 1935. I brought it up to 1987, and when we come back, I promise we'll be in 2022. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.